This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashran Johan. And on the show with me today is Ida Tien, the co-founder of Closing the Gap, a program to empower bright, deserving students to overcome the odds and enter ambitious universities. Now, Ida has been an education activist for quite some time now. She has worked for Teach for Malaysia at one point and is now also the deputy CEO of Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman, which powers Closing the Gap. Welcome to the show, Ida. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
All right. Ida, let's start from the top. What exactly is Closing the Gap all about? I know I brought it up, you know, briefly in the introduction, but perhaps you can paint a clearer picture.
Sure. So Closing the Gap is a nonprofit program that was started by my three co-founders and I about 5 years ago. And the goal of it was to empower students from underrepresented background with the skills, the knowledge and the mindset for them to apply for tertiary education and also to achieve their fullest potential after that.
Right. And how, I'm very curious, like, what inspired you to start Closing the Gap? Because this is a very specific cause. It's about education. Why is this cause important to you?
Right. So I think the starting of this is not as glamorous as I think people would imagine. I think at the time, so the four, I was still still working in Teach for Malaysia at the time, while my three co-founders were alumni of the Teach for Malaysia program. And so we had the chance encounter of meeting one of my co-founders, Brian, one of his ex-students that he used to teach when he was still in the program. And he was just a really bright boy who did really well in his STPM and also was one of the representatives for like the Math Olympiads and I think at the state or at the national level. And he did really well, but he wasn't sure about what to do after he finished STPM. I think he tried to make an application to the local public university system, but couldn't get what he wanted, even though he did really well in STPM. And I think like if there was an off-tangent conversation about this, we also know the many sort of like criticism about how STPM is being viewed quite unequally compared to other qualifications when you look at the local application process. So he was thinking, okay, since I don't get what I want, I'm just going to be a manager at like a market they store in Klang, which is impressive, I suppose, an 18-year-old to be a manager of a stall already. But we knew at the time that he shouldn't give up. And so we wanted him to explore other options as well, especially with the private options. But with the private options, it means that this particular student would not be able to afford it, given the background that he comes from. And at the same time, he wasn't sure about how to go about applying for scholarships, applying for private university, because it was not something that was introduced to him in his community. So we actually started this whole thing by sort of personally mentoring him for a few months. We got him to intern at Teach for Malaysia. We got him to practice his English speaking, get him to apply. And he had to actually apply for, because he had to sit for his IELTS in order to qualify for scholarships. He had to do it twice because he actually didn't get the necessary score at the beginning. And so he had to do it the second time. And we had to fundraise for that as well because the IELTS was so expensive. So it took about 8 or 9 months for us to actually got him to a point where he applied and he actually successfully got into Sunway University on the Jeffrey Chia Community Scholarship. And this was like 4 years back. He has now graduated. We're really proud of him because he's now also working in a medium-sized company as an accountant and really contributing back to his family who really needed it. And I think that experience sort of inspired us because we realized that there were so many other students who are just like this particular student of my co-founders. And in many ways, I think a lot of us do relate to that story too, no matter what background you come from, if you've gone to a Malaysian public school system. Were you told after SPM that things would go just fine? As long as you do well in SPM, you will go to university, but no one really teaches you about how to do these things. But I think what's more important is that the lack of knowledge or tools or guidance towards what happens after SPM hits students from underrepresented backgrounds the most, such as the student that we serve. And so at the time, we became quite inspired knowing that there was a mentoring program that was started in the UK called Futures. And it was hugely successful to utilizing mentoring and guidance to help students from these backgrounds to really aspire for ambitious universities. So that's how we reached out to them and decided, one of my co-founders, Kona, to think about how do we start off our first batch of students. At the time, we were aiming to have about 10 to 15 students as our first cohort of the Closing the Gap program, and really also to recruit our first batch of mentors as well from young professionals to come and help us inspire these students to actually through a two-year program so that they can apply for scholarships and university at the same time. So that's really how it all started, from really just one boy that we were trying to help.
Right. Now, talk to me about some of the challenges you faced when you first started this organization.
I think in the early stages, I mentioned just now, we were trying to look into how to bring this program from the UK to Malaysia.
Right.
So one of the things that we knew off the bat was that you can't import wholesale a program into Malaysia where the context is very different. So, for example, in the UK, with this, I would say majority, almost all of the students would go through the A-levels system after they are done with the O-levels. So in terms of the trajectory after A-levels, it becomes very consistent across the board, right? People go through A-levels, you apply through the UCAS system, and then you get into university through that way. But it's very different in Malaysia, where after Form 5, the options sort of branch out into multiple ways. And there are so many sort of options that are presented to you after Form 5. It can be really overwhelming. And so one of our challenges was, how do we then adapt that program to Malaysia, where it is not really true that all students go through a consistent sort of Form 6 experience together. So if, let's say, you go through Form 6, it's a good, I would say, 2 or 3 years before you even get to university, whereas if you take something like matriculacy or matriculation, it would be a good 1 year and then you get into a university as well. And so I think when you have such uneven experiences between students, it was quite a challenge for us to think about, okay, we can't quite create like a clear-cut 2-year program, for example, for our scholars, because not every scholar, unfortunately, would actually get into university after 2 years. And so I think there's a reason also why, if you notice in some of our promotion as well of the Closing the Gap program, we usually say 2 to 3 years program, because it really depends the destination that, the pre-university program that our students get into, and then after that, subsequently, what's university that they go to, because unfortunately, the timelines do not match up. And so that was one of our biggest challenges at the beginning. But how do we figure out to contextualize this program so that it fits with the Malaysian needs? Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think one of the things that we found to be very key to the program was scholarships. So this was not something that is very evident in the programs in the UK. But we knew with our students, it's not enough to get students into university. You need to also help them fund the university's studies and fees. And so we started to explore whether financial literacy was something that was important for us to introduce, maybe not as like a core component of the program, but was definitely something supplementary that we had to do. And two was, there was huge emphasis on helping them apply for scholarships.
Right.
So especially if you want to get students to apply for private universities or overseas universities, it was very, very integral that they actually score a scholarship. And we have quite a number of students who have had considered not going for certain universities because they couldn't afford going there. So despite them securing an offer, for example. But I would say the earlier stages of, I would say maybe in terms of managing Closing the Gap, it was quite difficult. Because perhaps, I think even though there were four of us who started this, eventually it was me and Connie who actually ran it full time. So having a 2-woman team running it was really fun. But there were, of course, a lot of challenges around resources. I mean, we knew that as we were recruiting more students, it was going to get more and more challenging. So, for example, as with the typical rules of a starting nonprofit, it was always a concern about fundraising. It's always a concern about whether or not we have enough to expand the team, but at the same time, be able to afford a runway of more than, let's say, 6 months, right? We were lucky that we never got to a point where we ran out of cash. Although at the very beginning, we actually ran a lot of our programs sort of like with in-kind sponsorship and donations,
right,
so that we didn't really have to use or fundraise any funding. So the earlier stages of trying to find the footing around our resources to gain that stability so we can scale our program was a bit of a challenge.
And speaking of that, right, perhaps you can tell me about the evolution of closing the gap. You know, there was at one point a different version of closing the gap, right? One that focused on literacy. And then now, over the years, it has evolved. And now closing the gap is powered by Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman, which you are also the deputy CEO of. So perhaps you can talk to me about that journey.
I would say, okay, it's a bit of a funny story, I suppose, about how we became Closing the Gap from the first iteration that focuses on literacy.
Right.
The simple story of it is just that two of my co-founders, Brian and Connie, when they were fellows who teach for Malaysia, they started a literacy program called Closing the Gap that's supposed to help students with raising their literacy in a lot of the more underrepresented communities and schools. So when we came up with the Closing the Gap that we know of now, we were sitting in my co-founder's sort of room, and we tried to figure out a name for it, and we just were drawing up a huge list of like names that we could use for our program, and nothing fits except Closing the Gap. And by the time the literacy focus Closing the Gap has already sort of died down, and it was actually being spin off by like another sort of lead for the original literacy program into My Readers, which is another program as well, the amazing program focusing on literacy with students. So we knew, okay, since the Closing the Gap name is starting to be distanced from literacy, let's just reuse it. So actually, we have our own WhatsApp group where it's literally called Closing the Gap 2.0. So that's how it started. We're just lucky that it has not been too much confusion within the first two or three years, and then it became a bit more of a distinct brand after that. But to your question as well about how YTAR or Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman came into the picture, was I think at a time when it was just a two-woman team of ours running Closing the Gap, we were approached by YTAR, that is a scholarship body that was set up in the name of Tunku Abdul Rahman himself. Has always been a body that gives a scholarship to students to pursue tertiary education locally. And it was also previously providing loans, but it has been that loan program has been stopped. But they actually approached us and asked if there was a discussion basically about actual hiring the team. So Closing the Gap came from me, and at the time it was my team member. And fun fact, my team member at the time was Kira, so from Undi 18.
Right. Okay.
Relationship with Undi 18 as well. So at the time we were basically asked if we wanted to sort of merge together. And for me, it just made a lot of strategic sense, right? Because Closing the Gap was always about university access. But one of our longer term plans is understanding that we actually wanted to set up our own scholarship actually in like a 5 or 10 years horizon, because we knew that that was the sort of thing that would be that would allow or provide the resources for our students to actually achieve their dreams. And so when YTAR came along, it seemed like the next piece of the puzzle of tackling how would it look like to support students at a university level to succeed. And prior to us joining YTAR, and perhaps the brand was not as well known as well, because even for me as well, when I first joined Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman, it was quite small. So it was quite unfortunate, right? Because they had so much potential, but people didn't know about it. So some of the biggest first task we went in was trying to find a more strategic alignment between what we were doing, Closing the Gap, as sort of like this pre-university intervention for underrepresented students. And how do we do that at the university level with the BTAR scholarship or the Tunku Abdul Rahman scholarship? And also at the same time, how do we expand and create a movement around these two, right? So one of the things we started doing, for example, is a lot of our Tunku scholars under the BTAR program or the Tunku Abdul Rahman scholarship program became mentors for our Closing the Gap program. Conversely, you now also have Closing Gap program students who then go on to apply to the Tunku Abdul Rahman scholarship program and became Tunku scholars themselves. But of course, the main team is not involved in the application or selection process for that, for the interest of course, the conflict of interest. But the whole point of us was thinking about how do we revamp then Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman to be a organization that focuses on developing young generation of leaders through higher education empowerment. And so we also revamped the Tunku Abdul Rahman scholarship so that it focused on underrepresented community more. We started to explore loosening our academic requirement, for example, because we knew that academic requirement threshold is actually quite a hard one to attain for a lot of students from such underrepresented background. And we became a bit more values focused as we look for students with the right values to contribute back to the country, contribute back to their community, and also how would they contribute back to this movement of empowering youth through higher education, or to really help them figure out what is the next step that not only empowers their own potential, but also the potential of the community. And I'm so really lucky because since then, with the support of the foundation, we have been able to expand the team. So now we have a team of about 8 people who are running Closing the Gap, the scholarship itself. We are also doing an employability program in partnership with Accenture that just ended, called Future Ready, also targeting underrepresented students. And as a result of that, we now primarily focus our fundraising on both raising the amount for our scholarship, but also the programmatic cost of Closing the Gap, which is a significantly easier task to do than to really fund for OPEX or salaries as well.
On the show with me today is Aida Tien, co-founder of Closing the Gap. After the break, I'll be asking her, if she had a magic wand, how would she address education inequalities and inequities in the country? Keep it here on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things, our Friday show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Aida Tien. She's the co-founder of Closing the Gap. So Aida, what's very interesting about Closing the Gap is that, you know, it's about preparing students for the post-SPM world.
Yes.
But what's interesting is, shouldn't SPM prepare students for the post-SPM world? Shouldn't the schooling system itself be, itself be sufficient? What do you think the Malaysian education system doesn't do well enough to prepare students for the post-SPM world?
I mean, Tashra, did you know what you wanted to do when you were 17?
No, I didn't. But exactly. And that's the problem, right? I'm trying to say, like, shouldn't schools prepare you for that?
Yeah, no, exactly, right? That's a good point, because I also didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I think when I was younger, I'm not so sure how I sold this illusion or this lie that, like, I just had to do well in school.
Yep.
And then after that, I'll get into university and I know I'll find a great job. And nobody has ever asked me, like, okay, that's where you want to get there, but how are you going to get there? And there was never a conversation that was had in school. And mind you, I'm also from one of the good schools, so-called, of Kuching. I'm from Kuching as well. And so it was interesting to see how even across the board in schools in Malaysia, there are very uneven methods or intervention to support students to navigate their life after Form 5. So there are some schools, for example, who have very strong, very comprehensive, counselling as well as post-SPM preparation workshops, perhaps for their students to get to or to navigate where they want to go to after Form 5. But it's not standardized across schools. Sure, we have counselors in schools, but counselors may wear multiple different hats in school. So I know, for example, when we speak to our students, nobody quite wants to go and see the counselor because there is this reputation that you go to the counselor, you either have a mental health issue or you have a discipline issue. And it's always more the latter than the earlier.
Mm.
And so it's very mixed about what is the role of the counselor. Because I, for example, when I was in secondary school, didn't know that counselors were supposed to be the people you go to, even to figure out what to do after Form 5. And this then becomes, it places an onus on the school, therefore, to really figure out how they want to tackle this problem after Form 5. Sure, it's great to get students to finish and complete their secondary school education, but what happens after that? And that's something that we find to have significantly disadvantaged students from underrepresented backgrounds more. Where as with more affluent or maybe the class students, for example, you are able to gain an inspiration perhaps from role models within your own community who have gone to university or have gone on to make a mark for themselves after Form 5. Or you have supportive parents who can find these resources for you. Or you have school teachers who connect you. Or even in some cases, your school itself is so affluent or a school that's so connected. Then you're connected to a very strong alumni network or a partner university that is invested in making sure that you make the right decisions. But with a lot of students from more disadvantaged background or from schools that maybe are more under-resourced, you don't get to have that access. So for example, you speak to some of our students in Closing the Gap at the very beginning of their pathway, of their journey, and you ask them, where would you want to go? What are the options presented to you after Form 5? A lot of them may be able to name two or three options, but they don't know what is beyond that. So if for them, they have exhausted this one or two options, they don't actually know that there are alternatives for them to aspire to. And this is not to blame schools or teachers. A lot of times, teachers themselves are maybe not trained to do this. And two, is because the workload for teaching should, of course, take precedence. So where does this post-SPM continuation sort of like support sit within the school curriculum? Right now, it doesn't sit quite anywhere. It sits with the counselor. It plays a very vague role. And unfortunately, that has put a lot of students from B40 backgrounds at a significant disadvantage as well.
Well, I'm learning a lot, you know, as I do in any interview. But one of the things I've learned today speaking to you is that you can actually go to your school counselor after Form 5 and you know, ask them what you want to do in your future and get it. I had no idea.
Yeah, but I think also at the same time to note as well how much support was also given to counselors to navigate through these things, right? Yeah, because again, counselors are wearing multiple hats.
Yep.
Like a quick comparison, for example, is if you look at the way Singapore does it, Singapore has a full comprehensive website, a full comprehensive curriculum to show how in every step or every phase of a student's education experience, how can that relate to something about career pathways, how could they relate to your university options or your vocational options after Form 5? Those are things that are integrated into the system already. Whereas I think it's a bit still a bit more patchwork in Malaysia, where some schools do it better, some schools may not have the resources to be able to do it, and we are lacking that overall picture about helping students get into the tertiary education in a way that it's not biased towards profit. So it's not about, you know, private institutions trying to get as many students into the universities, for example, with a disregard to really thinking about the core question, which is how do we get students to live the life they truly love? How do you get them to figure out what is the potential and what is the powerful pathway to allow them to really maximize their potential? And I think that sort of conversation has been lacking in our schools and the way we discuss universities as well.
Ida, what does education mean to you? Because, you know, we talk about education, and I think when it comes to, you know, wider society, even ourselves, you know, like we, you know, touched on a little bit earlier, this idea that, you know, when we were growing up, we were told you go to school, you get good grades, and you're set for life. Obviously, you know, that's not the case. I'm wondering, what does education mean to you right now? And, you know, did working at Teach for Malaysia, a lot of people, even like when I interviewed Soon Singh, for example, he said working at Teach for Malaysia was one of those things where it really changed his perspective of education. Was it the same with you?
I think that's such a big but important question to ask, right? And I think I've always taken education, I think for most people, to take it for granted as this thing that you have to go through. And I think I've never really quite examined what it meant as well until some of the turning points in Teach for Malaysia, which also includes co-founding Closing the Gap. And I think at the time, I was trying to figure out for myself, why is it so important for me that Closing the Gap happen, or why of all things that we focus on higher education especially? And I think it's a lot to do with how education is a way of satisfying choices and satisfying curiosity. And I look back at my own experience as well. Like my parents were not university educated. My dad and my mom came from rural parts of Sarawak. And a lot of times my dad growing up has been very, very clear to me about how I have the choices to actually pursue university wherever I want to be, and he'll be supportive of that. And I always took that for granted until I started Closing the Gap, and we realized when we speak to students as well in Teach for Malaysia that this is not the case for a lot of them. In many ways, to be able to do what you love is quite a privilege. To be able to think about what you want to do in the future is something that doesn't cross their minds. And I want to see education as a tool that that sort of frees them to allow to dream, and to also give them the tools to reach that dream. And I think in many ways, what is maybe sad, and I think some of the criticisms we've heard about the education experiences that many people go through, is that it's not that. Education is becoming a race to get the number of A's, which I guess some people may argue it's a way, for example, to get scholarships, to go to university. But I guess that's also why there's now a growing sentiment and growing conversation about how representative grades should be in allocating resources to students or to even get them to the aspirations or the ambitions that they have, right? So that's one, right, about this idea of what does it mean to say that a student, like, what does it mean to have enough education to get choices? Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that we need to shift towards something that's a bit more holistic, that education, if it's about giving people choices, then we also need to have a more holistic or comprehensive way of assessing a student's ability and the student's fit to the sort of pathways that they want to get into. But I think beyond that as well, I think one of the things that education means to me as well is about satisfying curiosity. Mm. And I feel like a lot of the conversation on education, understandably, is about how do you get students to be employable? And that is a very important part of the conversation of how do we make sure that students have the right knowledge and skills so that they become contributing members of society. But I feel in Malaysia, sometimes it's a conversation that's lacking about what it means to be a contributing member of society. Must it, for example, be students only in STEM? Because STEM is where it goes with research, with innovation, right? For example, we don't actually put as much emphasis on courses such as philosophy or anthropology, which at the get-go or from first sight doesn't seem to yield as much immediate ROI in terms of salary returns or in terms of how much business or profit it brings to businesses or even how employable this person is, right? And I think that's a very narrow way of looking at the purpose of education. Because if you look at a lot of places, for example, in the UK or in Singapore, where education is also about satisfying a curiosity, it's about enlightenment, right? And this actually gives you the sort of soft skills, the sort of understanding that allows you to really think about how do you become contributing members of society beyond the financial sense, beyond the business or capital sense, and thinking about how do you improve our lives. And I think that we are still lacking that. And I feel the ultimate purpose of education is really that. Like, how do you get people to be curious about the problems around them, how to solve it, be it whether or not it's something that's immediately employable in the industry that we recognize now, or industries that have not been created, but also in your own spiritual way, your own mental way as well, of what it means to satisfy learning, satisfy curiosity, and the questions and wonders about life.
Ida, how wide is the education gap in Malaysia? Because the stories that we do hear about, especially recently, are the ones where, you know, students have to climb trees and do their homework. And it's very, very heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But what does this actually mean? How much are these students losing out? And what are the long-term consequences of, you know, this inequality towards these students?
Yeah. I would say if there's a word that it comes down to talk about gap between underrepresented students as well as students who are more affluent, I think it all comes down to the word capital. I think we understand capital in one aspect. So the one that has often been talked about is about financial or resource capital, which is that students from more underprivileged background do not have access to the finances to help them fund their education. They do not have access to internet, do not have access to computers to allow them to succeed. But I think that only captures one aspect of what it means by capital deprivation that that really exacerbates this gap. The other one is really about the social capital, right? And I think this is the part that I think is often, or rather is not talked about enough in Malaysia. And what I mean by that is that there comes a set of experiences with being affluent that goes beyond having the money to afford this thing. It is having the connection that allows you easier access into opportunities, either for employment or for internship. It allows you this capital to understand and to go into sort of pop culture, sort of books that you read, the sort of TV or media that you consume, that ultimately gives you the cultural capital for you to be able to be seen, quote unquote, as an employable person or as someone who is deserving of going to XYZ university or XYZ education experiences. And I think that we don't realize how these are the unseen or at least not talked about capital that you accumulate simply from coming from the background that you're raised in.
And these are the precise sort of social and cultural capital that a lot of students from underrepresented backgrounds do not get. And why is this so important? It's because I think a lot of times the conversation in Malaysia has become about how we need to move towards something a bit more merit-based. And I understand where that sentiment is coming from, is that we should move away from race-based selection, for example, for universities or for scholarships or for allocations of, let's say, positions as well in companies, that you need to have more diverse selection of talent. But I think to move there to simply something that's focusing on merits also betrays a lot of these little unfairness that happens or injustice that happens when you talk about underrepresented communities. There is a book called The Meritocracy Trap that talks about this, that talks about how the myth of merit actually makes a lot of inequality worse. So, for example, people would think doing that, say, a CV blind interview would be the best way to assess a student's ability, let's say, to go through a scholarship interview or a job interview. But I would say and I would argue that a lot of cases that these perceive a more merit-based way of doing a process actually enhances a more affluent peer ability to stand out from the rest. Simply because now you have the other more intangible indicator of wealth. So for example, eloquence. Another one would be the wealth of leadership or exposure experiences that you have had in the past. Your ability to be able to grasp world affairs or general knowledge is something, all indicators of wealth that are now being seen as indicators of merits. And that is not fair for a lot of students from underrepresented backgrounds who do not have this exposure. And so I think that's why as well, you talk about education and capital, it's also really about how you give students this cultural equal access to this social and cultural capital, but at the same time recognizing that there is no way they could ever compare to the sort of capital that is afforded to students from more affluent background, and therefore how do we find more methods to make our process more equal and more fair and more equitable that doesn't just purely look at merits, that could really just be a mask for other indicators of wealth and inequality as well.
Right. And if you had a magic wand, Aida, how would you address these inequalities or inequities that you just brought up?
I think the answer, of course, everyone would say that the city complex is really complicated. There are different methods and different sort of perspective or angle that you need to tackle this. But I would say if there is one thing that I would wish that we do better, it's really money. It's really about cash allowances to people of struggling or underrepresented backgrounds. And I think obviously the idea of a universal basic income is something that has been discussed before. And I do think there's a lot of value in that. And even within the giving or the charitable sort of sector, there is a growing belief as well that giving cash directly to people from B40 background, for example, is one of the most powerful ways of lifting them out of the poverty trap. Giving out, for example, in-kind donations or food, for example, oftentimes lead to wastage, but it also leads to belief that people from B40 backgrounds or people who are in poverty are unable to make good decisions for themselves, which is not true. And a lot of times, I think there are a lot of research that has shown as well about how giving cash or giving money directly to beneficiaries so that they themselves can make a decision about how to spend their money wisely always turns out to be significantly more effective than giving in-kind donations. And yes, we've seen, for example, in some research as well, I think it was done in Africa, but how a lot of them eventually put this money, for example, into building small businesses that allows them to be able to create self-sustainability for themselves. And I think a lot of times when we look at a lot of the scholars that we work with too, sometimes it's a matter of just having the allowance to sustain their family so that they can focus on their education. And so to make this sort of allowance of cash contingent on some sort of good behavior or contingent on how you spend that money can sometimes backfire. A prime example, for example, is in our own scholarship. So Tunku Abdul Rahman scholarship, we had an amazing scholar. His name is Rasman. And I do have consent to share this story as well, because we have shared it on our social media too.
Right.
When we first got him in, he was at a 2.8 CGPA. With that CGPA, he would have been rejected by a lot of scholarships, understandably, because we're still in the phase of looking at academic indicators as a way of looking at your potential, right? So when we took him on the grounds that he had this amazing grit from a background that he had seen through various challenges but was able to overcome many of them, both personal and at a university level. For example, he wasn't able to use a laptop in university, so he's doing all his assignments on a phone, right? Mm. So we were hedging on this bet that if he came into the scholarship and was given the full allowance, because our scholarship is a full suite, a scholarship that provides every form of allowance as well, mm-hmm. including monthly allowance, we knew that he just needed that financial ability to start affording to live, to start affording to get a decent laptop, and to have the peace of mind of not worrying about whether or not I need to take a part-time job, for example, right. to be able to sustain myself and my family. And within a semester, his grades jumped up to, I think, 3.2 GPA.
Wow.
And I think that in itself, for us, was an indicator that a lot of times giving people financial freedom therefore gives them the mental freedom to think about other things that can help them upskill and actually get themselves to be more socially mobile as well.
Hmm. And I think this next question that I have sort of ties into that, because in a previous interview, I think it was one of your co-founders, Connie, who said, and I quote, it's also about opening up their mindsets and worldviews and helping them realize how important it is for them to begin thinking about their post-SPM plans now. What about the students' mindset or worldviews are you trying to change, or are you trying to make them see?
Yeah, I'm sure Connie will put it way better than I can, but I'm going to attempt this. So I think in our own journey, both with Closing the Gap and also coaching our scholars in the Tunku Abdul Rahman Scholarship, is realizing how important mindset is to determine the sort of pathways they actually go into. And what I mean by this is, in the beginning stages, for example, of us doing Closing the Gap, is we realized that our first hypothesis was that these students were also, we were taking in students who had such great potential already. All they did was a bit of a push, right? We give them the option to apply to the options that they want to, give them the financial ability to do so, and then they would flourish. It really wasn't the case. We had, for example, students who clearly had the ability to apply for some of the most competitive scholarships in the country, decided not to apply for it, or not even attend the interview, even when they were offered an interview opportunity, simply because of this mindset that they believed that they weren't good enough.
Right.
And this idea that what has been given to them is fixed. And every time I tell this story, people are just so confused or so perplexed as to why anyone would turn an opportunity away. But I think it's because we don't quite understand the sort of background of deprivation that you grow up with that really sort of paints this narrative of what you are allowed to achieve and what you are not allowed to achieve. Right. And to shift students to think from the mindset of what am I allowed to achieve to that I am allowed to achieve anything that I want to, as long as I put in the effort and I put in the time and the grit to see it through. And what we usually call it, and I think this is something that has been discussed by like Angela Duckworth and quite a number of researchers as well, which is the idea of a growth mindset, right? So a fixed mindset is one where you believe that everything that's been given to you is set and cannot be changed, versus a growth mindset where your ability is something that is growing, or you have this ability to change your own fate in that sense. So our role really is trying to see how do we build growth mindset into our scholars so that they become braver in dreaming for themselves, but also in thinking about the ability to change the lives of their communities too. So one of the things that we indicators that we try to capture in our impact measurement for Closing the Gap is beyond where they go to, which is the destination they have, beyond the skills that they should master. So these are competencies we believe will get them really far, both at the university level or beyond. Lastly, it's really the mindset or self-belief they have for themselves. For example, do they believe that they have the power or potential to become socially mobile or to climb up the social economic ranks? These are all very important indicators of a mindset that will keep, or they will gear them towards success. And what we find that students who have been able to master this sort of growth mindset are more resilient against challenges. So even if they get setbacks or rejections, they are more ready to stand up and try again. And that, to be honest, fundamentally is the most important skill to learn, not just for students from these backgrounds, but even for you and I in life as well. That growth mindset is the thing that will be, that will set us apart in terms of whether or not we'll achieve something or we won't.
I think you put it absolutely wonderfully there. Aida, now if there are students listening to this interview and they would want to, you know, if they're interested in the program, if they'd like to get in touch with y'all or try and apply for it, how can they go about it?
Oh, great news. We are actually now opening our 2022 cohort of the Closing the Gap program. So if you can actually go onto our Instagram or our website, and we'll be sharing a lot of the criteria to be part of our program. All we need is actually to apply, for you to apply through our application form. But I also actually want to call out to teachers out there as well, because we always find that teachers are the best way and are the best people to be able to harness this, what we call diamonds in the rough, in the students that they work with. So if you yourself know a really bright student from a challenging background who deserves a shot to actually apply for universities or whatever pathways they want to after Form 5, please do direct them to our social media or our website, because we're now opening applications for our new cohort for the next year. And for this as well, I want to mention that we also now have two programs. So we have our core Closing the Gap program that targets students in the Selangor and KL region. But with the advent of virtualization because of COVID, we also now have Reach Uni, which is our virtual program. And this is the one that we primarily want to target students outside of Selangor and KL. So for all teachers, all students listening from outside Selangor and KL as well, we really want to highly recommend you to apply or get students who are really high potential, who do not have access to the sort of financial or social or cultural capital that I spoke of just now, to really apply to our program for next year as well.
And how can interested parties contribute to Closing the Gap? Are you looking for contribution either in terms of funding or volunteering, things like that?
We definitely, firstly, I think the most obvious is that we also just open our application for our mentoring. So what is usually, how it usually works with our program is that we recruit young professionals or university students as well to become mentors, either a one-year mentor or two-year mentor for our scholars in both of our programs. And your role is really to guide and inspire one or a few mentor, a few mentees of yours in order to apply and get ready for life after post-SPM. That's one way of getting involved. Our mentorship application is also open now, so you can check it out in our website or our social media. Number two, yes, we are always looking for interested parties to help fundraise for us. This is both for the Closing the Gap program and our Tunku Abdul Rahman scholarship. So if you go to either one of our websites currently, we're always looking for interested organizations or individuals, either keen to sponsor a scholar through our Closing the Gap program or to sponsor a deserving scholar through our Tunku Abdul Rahman Foundation scholarship as well. And lastly, of course, we're always open to individuals or organizations who want to work with us in other ways. For example, providing exposure or internship opportunities at either your own organization or an organization that you know would be passionate to work with you from deserving backgrounds to allow them to open their horizon.
Aida, before I let you go, would you have a final message for us?
I think if there is a final message that I can give to everyone is to not underestimate the power of change that you have on people around you. A lot of our mentors, for example, join the program and have tremendous impact on the students that they actually serve or actually mentor. And I think a lot of times when we talk about change in the nonprofit world or change in terms of how do we make society a better place, it can often be said or discussed in very lofty terms. But in the end, it really boils down to you helping that one student or that one cousin or that one person that you met in a random organization or in a random chance encounter one day, to for you to change that life will have a lot of ripple effects to come. So don't underestimate your power actually through mentoring, through guidance, to actually help someone achieve a version of themselves that they never knew they could.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Aida.
No worries, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me again.
That was Aida Tien, co-founder of Closing the Gap. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. the Business Station.